Should we ask the audience if they're ready?
Yeah. I'm going to call this meeting of the House Committee on Early Childhood and Family Supports to order for Thursday, February 9th, 2017. I would remind members that we still are open for opportunities to introduce committee measures, so as we continue to have these conversations, I welcome your input and discussion on that. I don't want to put you on the spot, Representative Hack, but you did send me a...
Oh, yes, I did.
You sent me an email. Would you like to just briefly inform the whole...
Here, I have the email.
Yeah, that'd be helpful.
Yeah.
On the issue. We have, 50 things coming up all at once all the time?
But I appreciate you doing that, but I just thought the whole committee ought to be aware of your...
Okay. So, thank you, Mr. Chair. This relates to the Oregon pre-kindergarten funds, and there is a trigger that is met at certain points, and it allows for additional funds to kick in to help other families that may not qualify for the Head Start and the Oregon Pre-K. So it opens it up to families that may not qualify financially. They may make a little bit too much money and not be able to have their kids in pre-K. So once you hit a certain point of the number of children in services, is my understanding, I have a lot to learn in it, then it's supposed to hit a trigger, and we think Oregon might be there, but apparently you have to go after the federal dollars once you hit the trigger. And so I just want to explore and find out, have we hit the trigger? How close are we to this trigger? What does that mean? And how do we access those funds so more of our families can get services? And I don't know how that works. So hopefully we can find out.
Cool.
Okay.
And thanks to my pre-K friends, that was brought to my attention.
Okay, so we'll have put that on our agenda and we'll follow up.
Perfect.
But I appreciate you bringing that to our attention. So anything else before we move on to the... Okay. So I'm going to open informational meeting, and so we're first going to be hearing from Early Learning Hubs. So we have the information still correct. The panel one is Dorothy, Louise, and Olga. Welcome. And for the record, if you just provide your name for the record as you speak, we'd appreciate
it. Good afternoon, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Hack, Vice Chair Pelluso, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dorothy Spence. I'm the Hub Director for Northwest Early Learning Hub, which covers parts of Columbia and Tillamook County. I recognize a few faces. Never been in this role before. So I'm really here today just to provide a general overview of the Early Learning Hubs and then step back and let the hubs that are here to really bring the life of their work to you and present that. I'm privileged to be joined by hub representatives from across the state, and they're here to share examples of what community-driven cross-sector collaboration looks like in action, and really the most important part, how that action improves the lives of children and families in our communities. So as mentioned last week, there are 16 early learning hubs throughout the state, and structurally each hub has a backbone organization, which is the entity that provides the organizational and operational support for the hub. Hubs also have a governing body with cross-sector membership. And additionally, in order to support the cross-sector collaboration and ensure a community-driven process, each hub has developed their own process of utilizing community and parent advisory councils, as well as work teams. The early learning hubs have been charged with three specific goals. These are our common goals across our 16 hubs: to create an early childhood system that is aligned, coordinated, and family-centered, ensuring that children arrive at school ready to succeed, and ensuring that Oregon's young children live in families that are healthy, stable, and attached. As community-driven organizations, hubs have the flexibility to determine at a local level the strategies and activities that will address the needs of the community and meet our common goals. So often we're asked, who's exactly at the table for early learning hubs, and how is that different than before? So statutorily, we have five sectors that are required to be a part of each hub's governing body. Those are K-12, business, health, social service, and early learning providers. And what we've tried to do here today is provide panelists that represent different parts of those sectors and talk a little bit about that kind of collaboration that happens with hubs. One of our greatest assets as early learning hubs is being able to have both new and traditional players at the table. So these are some additional partners that hubs often collaborate with around strategies and leveraging investments. Oregon Parenting Education Cooperatives, I understand you have an informational hearing about those coming up, and you'll learn a little bit more. DHS, P3 initiatives through OCF, which are privately funded grants, CCOs, business partners in K-12, RAC and STEM partners, and local community organizations. Bringing these folks together around common goals and strategies means that there are opportunities to align and leverage investments. As noted last week, the developmental stage and organizational age of hubs is a range. So our oldest hub is 3 years old, and our youngest hubs are just over a year old. So what that often means is we have a diversity of strengths across our hubs, and we have diversity of strengths across our communities. But twice a year, we are very committed to doing shared learning and learning from one another. And so twice a year, all of the early learning hubs come together for a learning collaborative to be able to share our best practices, to learn from one another. And the panelists here today, much of what they're going to talk about, I've actually learned through those learning collaboratives. We've really tried to develop a culture of shared learning and open communication, and often we'll reach out to one another for support and help. And one kind of final note before I stop talking and really turn it over to the people who can share the highlights of the work in action. Our hubs are driven by data and our communities. So we analyze data. Hub governing bodies and advisory councils are able to identify the greatest disparities in the community. And with input from advisory councils and community engagement sessions, hubs are able to develop solutions rooted in what our communities tell us they need, and more importantly, what the community tells us is going to work for them. So before I turn it over to Olga and Luis, I did want to mention, unfortunately, one of our panelists today, Renee Brandon, is not able to come up from Southern Oregon. So she hit some bad weather and hydroplaned a few times. But unfortunately, she was going to be here to share their amazing work on trauma-informed care that they've been doing in their collaborative. The slide's still in the presentation, and I believe that her testimony has been uploaded to OLA, so you can read more about that. And I'm sure she's happy to answer questions by email. And then in the meeting materials, the Parent Advisory Council from Early Learning Multnomah has submitted a letter to share a little bit about how their Parent Advisory Council has provided input and collaboration as their early learning hub.
Huffman, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dorothy, you're doing a great job. I'm just not sure why you thought it was okay to leave your legislative work and go to early learning.
I see.
I'm
sorry,
just saying.
I'm afraid someone might ask that. Yeah. Do I have to say community-driven one more time? It has been super fun to see just this work come alive in communities, and it's because of the people I'm here with today, honestly. They're amazing.
As opposed to us people over here.
I wasn't going to say I'm offended now, but...
Thank you.
Okay. Chair John Lovely and honorable legislators, good afternoon. My name is Olga Merecias Cuevas. Thank you for the opportunity to be here. I am honored to highlight works from Early Learning Washington County Parent Advisory Council. As an immigrant that moved to the United States when I was 10 years old and a parent of a three-year-old, it's a privilege to be a part of Learning Washington County and be the voices of all the children and families in our communities. And most importantly, being part of a mission that provides services to children and families in our region who most needs them. Early Learning in Washington County wants to make sure that every child has access to the right education, especially in their earlier years, which are the most fundamental years. Early Learning in Washington County is creating new partnerships across K-12 schools, health, human services, and businesses that will change the way we currently support young children and families in our region to lead to more effective and efficient services. For example, we started Preschool Promise, a program where children as young as 3 years old have access to a high-quality, full-day preschool, culturally relevant preschool program. As a result of our Kindergarten Readiness Partnership and Innovation Grant, our community has seen an increase on education for children along with family support. By providing Preschool Promise, we are helping children in our community get a head start on their education and providing a brighter future for them. We are showing our community that we are here to fight for better education, especially parents that can't afford to pay preschool. Families up to the 200% of the poverty line are eligible for free preschool under our program. We are making sure that we are representing all families by providing brochures, flyers, and even a TV commercial in different languages. I was humbled by the fact that a commercial was made in my native language, Mixteco, from Oaxaca, Mexico. I was impressed that an organization would take that extra step to make sure everyone feels welcome. Thank you for your time. I hope that these words coming from a mother who is among the 200% of poverty and fighting for a better future for her three-year-old helps you understand that it's very important keeping programs like Preschool Promise. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, honorable legislators. My name is Luis Nava, and I'm the president of the Early Learning Pack from Washington County, the advisory committee. And the reason why I'm here is just to remember that, you know, we have an educational system that has too many components, and the whole idea and the goal is to get the best experience for our children, for education children, you know. So for this purpose is that we join this effort as a parent. And sometimes in the past, we are trying to be a little bit more engaged, more proactive, but it was not a way to do it, you know. But at this particular time, we are very grateful to having this opportunity as a parents and members of the community to be part of this idea, to be part of this movement. And we are very sure that with our efforts, we can contribute to the other side, that is the education, the educators, because we as a parents being involved, we are giving the other support that our schools needs. So that's one of the most important parts that why we are engaging this. And also, the other reason that we are here is because in the past year, we got the opportunity to be part of this pack, and we work almost for the full year trying to establish our organization, the mission, the character, and what we want to do with our community and in our communities. But the most important part for us as a parents is for the first time, the executive committee or the people who is making the decisions listen our recommendations, and they put those recommendations into the plan. So that for us, that's a lot, because now we've been recognized for that. And since then, we developed our workshops that we are starting having those workshops in Washington County, because this is where we live. And we are just seeing those new transformations, new engagement from the parents. And now we are asking here for your financial support to keep going with this project, because we are ready to start sharing this experience with the other 15 PACs. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you can help us.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? So, Dorothy, I don't know if you're the correct person, but I'd like to, and maybe somebody's already told me this, apologize if they have, but each hub has potentially different members on their council or that. So is there some guidelines talks about the breadth of who those people should be, or how does that work?
So each hub has a governing structure that's required to have the five statutory sectors,
five,
right?
Yeah.
So, but beyond that, it's really determined on a local level, both the number of folks at a steering committee, as well as who else is represented. And some of that is because we have different kinds of local organizations that need to be represented at that table. So in some cases, you have a lot of K-12 representation or organizations that work with K-12, and in other areas, a strength may be something else. So other than that five kind of statutory members kind of at the governance level, it really just depends on the community and what the strengths of the community are.
Perfect. Thank you. Any other questions?
Can I add one more thing?
Certainly.
That I forgot. And can you see that picture? That's part of our group.
Oh, nice.
And
oh,
you can see there is people from South America, from here, from Europe, from Asia, from Africa, from the Mid-East. So we are carrying the voice and the experiences for everybody, not only us.
Thank you. Very impressive. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
If you don't mind, I'm going to stay up here to help with the presentation with other folks.
I can't assure what some members may ask you yet, Dorothy, but okay. Okay, so Iris Bixler from Cornerstone and Julie Manning. Okay.
Thank you.
Welcome. Can you just introduce yourself for the record before
yes.
you speak? Thank you.
My name is Iris Bixler. Good afternoon, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Hack, Vice Chair Peluso, and members of the committee. Like I said, my name is Iris Bixler, and I'm the Family Resource Navigator for Cornerstone Community Housing. I'm honored to be here today to highlight the work of the Lane Early Learning Alliance and its impact on creating coordinated, aligned systems for children and families. Excuse me, I'm recovering from a cold. Cornerstone Community Housing has been a leading provider of high-quality, affordable housing and resident services for the past 25 years. In 2015, United Way and Cornerstone aligned efforts to address the needs of Lane County's low-income families and was funded by a grant from Meyer Memorial Trust to hire a family resource navigator. My role serving low-income families allows me the opportunity to encourage participation in existing parenting resources, ensures access to medical and mental health services, and support engagement in community activities that foster school readiness. These goals were accomplished through a program I designed called the Family Check-In. The Family Check-In is a series of three visits, either in the resident's home or their affordable housing community center. Each visit focuses on positive parenting support, family goal setting, and resource referrals. The unique benefit of my position being embedded in affordable housing is that I'm a trusted member of their community, and because of this, I have the ability to create safe dialogue that leads to more effective referrals with a high rate of follow-up. The systems alignment work that I do is focused on improving and promoting services between housing, social services, and the Lane Early Learning Alliance. This work is strategically planned and has long-term benefits to residents. By coordinating local resources to serve residents right on site, we break down barriers to access. A couple of examples of this coordination are: through a new collaboration with the Child Center, a nonprofit that provides parenting education and family therapy, a therapist provides counseling on-site at several of our properties and offers an on-site six-week collaborative parenting class, complete with free dinner and childcare. Another example is an MOU that was created between Affordable Housing and WIC, which means that residents who attend a cooking class at their property's community center fulfills their WIC requirements, thus eliminating the need to travel to downtown Eugene, sometimes on several buses with small children. I've also coordinated outreach opportunities for local agencies to promote parenting programs, such as Preschool Promise and Triple P Parenting Education, directly to Cornerstone residents at events being held in their affordable housing community centers. Providing a family resource navigator in affordable housing aligns with all three of Lane County's Community Health Improvement Plan priority initiatives, including creating social and economic opportunity, promoting healthy behaviors, and finding ways to expand collaborative infrastructure. It also directly aligns with the Lane Early Learning Alliance metrics to engage families with meaningful, coordinated, and family-centered programs, as Dorothy was talking about, to support families entering school ready to succeed, and that families are healthy, stable, and attached. I want to highlight a few data points. In 2016, I provided the family check-in to 24 families, doing a total of 62 home visits. I made 387 referrals and marketed family-friendly community events in affordable housing newsletters to over 3,000 households every month. Upon completion of the family check-in, 100% of applicable families reported their child had completed a developmental screening. I think data and numbers are critical components when looking at effectiveness and reach of a program. However, I also believe that the individual stories of the families this work affects is important to share. I'd like to briefly tell you the story of a mother I worked with last fall named Rebecca and her son Jason. They're pictured there. Even joyous events like the birth of a new baby can be stressful for siblings. Jason was thrilled that he was going to be a big brother, but as the birth of his baby sister neared, he began to exhibit some frustrating behaviors. When Rebecca expressed her concern during one of our home visits, we brainstormed ways she could help support him. In the end, we came up with the idea of taking a mother-son yoga class. Through a partnership with a local yoga studio, I help facilitate the family receiving a scholarship to attend classes. As it turns out, striking a few yoga poses and having special time with mom was a turning point in Jason's behavior. After just a few short months, Jason's mom reported that her son had made a, quote, total turnaround. He was using new techniques to manage his actions and emotions, and his academic work improved. Now that his baby sister has arrived, he's an amazing new brother. He's an amazing brother. As a result of the partnership between Early Learning Hub and Affordable Housing, we have been able to better align systems, bring new and needed services directly on site to the families most in need. I encourage you to continue to support this innovative, necessary work. It's been an honor to be here with you today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Julie Manning. Good afternoon, Chair Lively, Vice Chairs Hack and Peluso, and committee members. Thank you for providing this opportunity for my colleagues and me to briefly share with you some of the promising efforts currently underway in conjunction with Oregon's Early Learning Hubs. As I mentioned, my name is Julie Manning. I work for Samaritan Health Services, which is a regional health system based in Corvallis that serves residents of Benton, Linn, and Lincoln counties. I co-chair the board of our region's Early Learning Hub, and I represent our CCO on that board. I've been asked to focus my remarks today on some of the collaborative work involving our CCO and our Early Learning Hub. I have two examples to discuss. First, the next slide. The next slide, this talks about, this is a first look at an innovative new program developed in our region called Polywog, which moves the provision of parent education and resources further upstream to include prenatal and childbirth education for expectant mothers and families. Sort of the basic concept of this collaboration is to take two very important touch points for education and information sharing, which is for expectant parents, and that education silo is typically really housed within the healthcare provider setting and local hospitals. And then the baby's born, and a lot of times new parents sort of fall into the abyss, and they may or may not find their way to a very robust parent education silo that typically is housed within the education community. So the concept is really to bring those two very important components of education and resources together, and that's what Polywog is designed to do. Essentially, beginning at the time that the expectant mother begins her prenatal visits and is offered the opportunity to sign up for a variety of classes, the visiting nurse or the provider within the clinic setting or a maternity care coordinator can then sign the mother up on the spot using a tablet, accessing the Polywog website to sign up for the classes beginning with during her prenatal time, and then continuing all the way through and after her pregnancy. One of the, I think one of the most important factors of how Polywog is designed is really at the back end, which is a HIPAA-compliant portal that allows this information and the parents' interests, with the parents' permission only, to be accessed then by other service providers. So it sort of becomes a single door of entry for programs and services that can really help support that mom and child and family throughout and beyond her pregnancy, whether it's access to WIC services, child care resource and referral, any number of classes that may meet the family's interest. This work has been supported by a grant from our CCO to the Early Learning Hub. And as I mentioned, the Polywog features a website. All of the information is provided in English and in Spanish, and is also adaptable to to the mobile device of telephones or tablets. The information, in addition to being accessed by the website, can also be accessed by telephone. And again, as part of the grant support from the CCO, the telephone line is staffed by folks at our parent education hub, which in our region is at Lynn Benton Community College, which also serves as the staffing hub for our early learning hub. So there's really a great opportunity there to work together. After more than a year of planning and development, Poliwog is set to go live later this month, beginning in Albany and then expanding to the other communities that we serve. And we look forward to sharing our results with you at a future meeting. The second example that I'd like to share in terms of our CCO and Early Learning Hub collaboration relates to a recent, highly successful training for healthcare providers using the Ages and Stages questionnaire. The acronym is ASQ. The ASQ is a developmental screen for children ages 0 to 3, and it's a quality metric for both the Early Learning Hubs in Oregon as well as our CCOs. It's an important tool for detecting early developmental delays that can often be effectively addressed through referrals to early intervention or early special education programs. So we want as many of our providers as possible to regularly use the ASQ and to refer their patients as indicated. With partial support from a Ford Family Foundation grant, an initial ASQ provider training was held last spring in Newport. After the training, several physician clinics also participated in follow-up coaching and technical assistance from the Oregon Practice-Based Research Network. The acronym is ORPRIN, and it's based at OHSU. As you can see from the data shared from the slide, and this was just from one of our pediatrics clinics in Newport. So you can see on the right-hand side of the slide, 4 months prior to the ASQ training, the providers in that pediatrics clinic in Newport had completed 23 ASQs. 4 months after they completed the training, the same group of clinicians had completed 209 ASQ screenings. And then follow-up referrals to either early intervention or early special education prior to the training, 7 referrals after the training, 22. So based on that highly successful program in Newport, now the CCO has provided funding to our Early Learning Hub to expand that training to providers in Benton and Linn counties. And so that work is taking place throughout this year. These are just two examples of the powerful collaborative work underway throughout the state that is facilitated by the multidisciplinary composition of the Early Learning Hubs. It's been exciting to see what these groups have been able to accomplish in a relatively short amount of time working together. And we look forward to sharing more with you about how these efforts are transforming our young children and families. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So whichever one of you can answer this, on the Poliwog, is that contracted through early learning or through the hub?
In terms of the staffing for the Poliwog service, or what do you mean the contract?
Let me tell you what I'm getting at and why I'm a little nervous.
Okay.
We had a bill in 2015 on student privacy rights, and there were there are companies out there that would like to gain access to our kids and farm a lot of information from them. And we prevented the companies from doing that. And we were largely looking at K-12, but when you talked about this, now I want to dig deeper because I have a concern. I don't want to stop it at K-12 and then find out that we're doing it in early learning. Google happened to be an example that contracted with ODE, State Department of Education, and so that was the model that we've set, that you work through the department at state level. and not bypass that and try to work with the individual schools or go straight to the parents and kids under a different guise. So I'd like to pursue that, maybe Dorothy or David. Maybe.
Would you like me to answer the question?
Yes.
Okay. Essentially, the back door to Polywog is a data system called Vista Logic. That's the provider and also the system. It is housed. The agreement to operate the program and the system is through the Early Learning Hub. That is where the funding and the sort of the project construct has come from, and essentially. The patient needs to consent at the front end to make her information available through Polywog to be in a format that could be accessed by any other service provider. And so it's essentially sort of held in that box that has been built exclusively for the use of this program. I don't know if that answers your question, or
you may have made me a little more nervous.
Okay.
I'll pursue this with David in particular.
Very
and,
good.
And make sure that that we're not doing one-offs when we have clear state policy and state funds are being involved in education. So I have some concerns, and hopefully they're misplaced. And I'll just get a clearer understanding of what's going on.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation, and I love to see the integration of housing, Navigator, helping find support systems for families who have a lot that they're struggling with, and then, of course, the healthcare system. So I was just going to ask about a few of the issues that you didn't call out right away. You probably have dealt with child care. How big of an issue is that, trying to find affordable child care? This housing, people are really lucky to be in this housing. I'm assuming it's subsidized, and so that is fairly stable for them. I'm not sure if there's a wait list for that, but love to hear about that. In terms of integrating with the healthcare system, oral health, we know that that many of the women who are giving birth to babies are on Medicaid, and we've not done a very good job of getting prenatal oral healthcare out to that population, and I'm wondering if now that you have them in one place, that's a part of your strategy. Mental health, same kind of question. Healthy food, you did mention WIC, but you know, are you able to bring farmers markets to, you know, one of the ideas I love is, in addition to giving vouchers out to people to make use of at farmers markets, or giving them a $5 or $10 boost on a SNAP card, EBT card, they still have an access problem getting there. And so when you have them in one housing, you know, one location, and you can bring it there, those are some of the innovations, I think. Even providing child care in the place, so there's employment for people in the housing. Of course, it has to be zoned that way. But so those are just some of the pieces that are pieces of innovative policy, and I'm wondering if you've dealt with any of those in your project.
Did I feed you those questions? Those are perfect. To answer your first question, yes, child care is a huge issue. Preschool Promise providing free child care was the most exciting program that families that I saw heard about. They were scrambling to get involved in that. But it is a constant issue to find affordable child care for the families I work with. Wait list for housing, yes. We have 10 properties. Our largest property has about a 6-month wait list, and one of our most popular properties has about a 5-year wait list. We get calls hourly about housing, so it is a huge, huge need. We had a family walk through the door yesterday. She's homeless with 3 kids, and she's desperate to find housing. So it's a big problem in our region. Food access, yes. So we collaborate with Cornerstone collaborates with 50 different local agencies to provide on-site resources. One of our biggest folks that we collaborate with is Food for Lane County, our local food bank. So twice a month at each of our properties in our community centers, we have what we call extra helping, and it's basically a free, fresh farmer's market. Hmm. So folks can come down from their home with a bag and fill up to the brim fresh fruits and vegetables. It's often bread and yogurt and things like that too. So yeah, those are innovative, amazing things that I think housing and what I think has been so exciting about this past year for me. I came from the social service world and I'm new to housing. Mm-hmm. So being able to sit at the table with folks that I knew from the social service world, mm-hmm. and bring them the idea of, we have community centers that would welcome you, mm-hmm. to come and talk to our families about your services. They're thirsty and ready and available to you to really do that outreach piece. So it's been exciting to see those collaborations and conversations happen, and I really am hopeful that those things are going to continue.
I would just add a couple of comments related to your questions around the integration of health-related services, and I think that there's a common theme here that is, to what degree are we able to wrap services around and to make them as easily accessible for the client as possible? And in the healthcare setting, the CCOs, as you know, have really promoted an integrative model based in the patient-centered medical home, primary care home, that integrates oral health, mental health, and physical health services. And typically, those medical homes are typically staffed by either family physicians or internal medicine physicians. And so in our region, we have been able to integrate behavioral health specialists. Usually they are clinical psychologists, but increasingly now they are also supported with navigators and community health workers and other kinds of sort of hybrid health and social service professionals to help in that arena, as well as staff who've been trained in motivational interviewing to help as health coaches with patients who are trying to deal with managing their chronic conditions, such as diabetes or high blood pressure, congestive heart failure, things like that. And in terms of how that impacts children, to the degree, and I would mention one other thing related to oral health, and that is that we've really been able to forge some great partnerships with dental health organizations in the region, and actually housing extended practice dental hygienists in our primary care medical homes, who actually provide preventive services for patients in the medical setting. And that's been a very, very well received service that we are looking to continue to expand in the region. And I think all of that sort of, as you have healthier parents, you ultimately have the opportunity to have healthier children. I would just make one other note. One of the newer quality metrics for the CCO is to apply sealants, protective sealants, on the erupting molars of young children. And again, the dental health organizations have been very strong partners in getting out to the schools and working with us and with other service providers to help ensure those young children are getting those protective sealants. So.
Very good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Can I just say one more thing?
Oh, sure.
I was waiting to see if my...
Sorry.
That's right. Interruption of Hayden.
I was waiting for him.
Let it slide. Thank you.
He's a dentist, so we work on oral health issues together. Thank you for all that work. And I know there's a lot of opportunity to maybe do education, oral health education, in the housing, because of course it's not just the visit to the dental hygienist or dentist every 6 months. It's the brushing, and I know you're passionate about that, so that's why I was waiting for you to see if you had any suggestions there.
Representative Hayden. Certainly.
Yes, thank you, Chair. Yes, I do, and we did work on a pilot project and would like, if we could get the support for it, to include teaching brushing on a daily, weekly, some sort of basis at a very young age, to where we get the toothpaste and, if the parents agree, some fluoride in it, or if not, better to brush with non-fluoride than not at all. Take it out. We're flexible with that. But to get some actual hands-on, either at some engagement here. We tried in the school system and and kind of got shut down.
It was a five-week session.
So we may try again in the future, but would love to expand on the concept of working with oral health organizations and actually getting into the program sometime where you know, toothbrush and a couple of minutes can really go a long ways for the future of those kids.
I do believe, just in very brief response, that I do believe as the dental health providers are going in to apply the sealants, that they do leave the children with dental oral hygiene kits and some initial information about basic good oral hygiene. So certainly we can look to build on that. Thank you.
Well, and just to follow up to that, so the sealants are usually first or second grade.
Yes.
And we don't want to wait that long. And I know that there have been some pilot projects with WIC actually applying for fluoride varnish. And so the earlier we can start, including
yes.
The pregnant women in your projects with education, because we know what dental caries causes inflammation, which has profound impacts on the fetus. So
I'm a certified community health worker and certified doula from the Oregon Health Authority, and I'm a part of the Traditional Health Worker Commission.
Great.
And I know that a big part of the Traditional Health Worker initiatives right now are to train those types of workers in oral health care. So I think that it's coming, too. I think that's an important piece.
Fantastic.
Good work.
Great.
Thank you.
Very nice. Good work. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, it was.
So next we have Jeff Taylor, Rosa Floyd, Kelly Ho, in particular for Kelly, who traveled, I think she gets the award for traveling the furthest today. We really appreciate your getting here. Did you leave snow?
A lot of snow.
That's what I figured.
No, I'm not asking for
Okay. Whoever wants to go first, just introduce yourself for the record, please.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. So good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Taylor, and I am the honored principal of Nellie Muir Elementary in Woodburn. And it is a bilingual district. And I am here today, sorry to say, with my favorite kindergarten teacher.
You are on the record, you know.
Nobody watches this.
Right?
Oh!
We're really eating it over here.
Yeah.
Oh, you're absolutely right.
So I am here with my favorite kindergarten teacher. This is Mrs. Floyd. She has worked tirelessly over the last 20 years to support students and parents in their education and their well-being. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I am honored to highlight our partnership with Marion and Polk County Early Learning Hub to create a coordinated and aligned system for children and families. This year's pre-kinders are in the class of 2030s.
Wow.
Just think about that for a second. I can remember when I was a kid, when my mother and I would talk about the changeover of the millennium.
Yes.
And what that would look like. Mm. Many of the jobs that they will compete for haven't been dreamed of and won't be for some years to come. Supporting students before they enter kindergarten is an imperative and a part of our promise to the next generation. This can only be accomplished through partnerships, specifically with early learning hubs, and in our case, the Marion and Polk Early Learning Hub. As a district, we have partnered with learning hubs and our community to provide parent education as a specific family engagement strategy. Together, we've been able to create opportunities for early learning providers and kinder teachers to align curriculum and strategies to ensure that there is a smooth transition from pre-kinder into kinder. We've done this by way of parent education, which provides families with a meal, age-appropriate and activity-based child care while parents attend classes. We have seen tremendous growth and engagement in these programs.
Thank you for the opportunity. My name is Rosa Floyd, and I've been working in the district for 17 years. I'm very honored to work with the program. I've just been asked to give some examples of the things that we've been doing in the district. And I would like to mention first that we are very excited about the high percentage of parent involvement that we have in our district with the program. having from 40 to 60 parents at night. Then we create a program for parenting classes, but at the same time, we have a curriculum that we create for the students, not provide childcare, but meaningful opportunities for academics, specifically for math and literacy activities, and embedded with art and science during the same time that the parents are being taught with work with the students with these activities. And at the same time, we have the opportunity to co-teach with the preschool teachers in the district from different programs, OCDC or Head Start, and that provides the overview for those teachers to see how we can align the curriculum and be prepare these preschool students for the time that they come into our district for the dual program language. At the same time, we serve the kids that they don't have the opportunity to attend to any preschool school. Then our program has been very exciting, and it's been growing a lot. We have different parenting classes through the year, and of course the classes for kinder readiness in the program.
So this collaboration has allowed us to connect pre-kinder with kinder and make that transition really happen smoothly. One thing that we see is pre-kinder coming into Ms. Floyd's classroom and seeing how it's done there. And then she pushes into the pre-kinder area and does demonstrations there. And that collaboration has been phenomenal. And then the parent engagement piece. And if I could share, in the community that we work in, this is really a one-on-one proposition. This is Mrs. Floyd using her weekends and using her Christmas time to call those parents, because that continuity between pre-kinder and kinder is incredibly important. And we thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Hack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So back to the parent involvement. I know, talking with a lot of our schools and our programs, that is one of the toughest things to do. And I know you just mentioned that, you know, your incredible outreach and what you do there. Can you tell us is there something that we can do to assist our programs and our schools? I mean, not everybody is like you and can do that. And also we can't expect folks to do that. How do we bridge that gap? I know we have a kind of a culture divide there, and it's not just that. I mean, it is extremely difficult, and I think that is a huge issue.
I think for the parents, it's very important to see and listen from the people that is going to be teach them to invite it at the same time, because I create a relationship and they feel compromised to come and do their part. For me, it's really important to contact directly personally, because they can hear my voice. I can really answer the questions and explain and let them know that this is a great opportunity for their children, and they can let it go, because it's not going to come back again. And the more we present, more of these opportunities we're going to create. And it's not just call them one time, but I think that everybody's busy. Then we do a second or third time phone call if we need it. And we go do home visits in case their needs are different. Then I think that first contact build accountability, and also that relationship that is going to last not just for this, but for the rest of the school. You bring in the parents, and we are the bridge to embrace. We start that relationship, and a lot of parents, they're unused to the system. They're new in the system, they're afraid to ask, and it's what is important, this contact with them. You answer their questions and open the doors to the district.
Can I just make a comment? And I think you hit spot on, and I think Lisa Harnich is out in the crowd, and I'm thinking she's going to come up, and hopefully she's going to touch on this too. But I think that's exactly it. We've got to start early making that connection, and I think it's the connection between the home visiting and then getting them into the classroom and bridging that gap and making them feel comfortable and knowing that you belong here and that this is your place and you need to be here. So I just appreciate your perspective, and thank you for the work that you do, and we need more of you.
Oh, thank you. It's just, and I think it's not just for that, but it's going to be for life, for the rest of the school. Then it's, it's just started right, and it's going to continue.
Representative Kindergartner.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. So thank you, Ms. Floyd. Can you tell me how many students are in your class and how many are native English speakers?
I have a dual classroom right now with 25 students in my regular classroom, and I have 8 English speakers, and that is, I have some dual language, bilingual, excuse me, and some Spanish, but only English students, I have 8.
So I just want to thank you for all the work that you do inside the classroom and outside on your vacation time, Christmas, et cetera. And it's great that you have someone who's so supportive of you.
Thank you.
Representative Bynum.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much for your testimony and coming here today. I'm the mom of a first grader, and in our Christmas letter we put in that, you know, we were just so happy that he got out of kindergarten. and I had to say more in the Christmas letter because I didn't want him to have a complex, you know, when he looked back 15 years about how I couldn't say anything else, but he got out of kindergarten. But what I remember about that relationship was that the teacher always built the relationship with us. And I just wanted to appreciate teachers like you that provide regular contact with families. I worked on the North Clackamas Equity Committee, and the question, as Representative Hack has brought up, is how do we get parents into the classrooms? And one of the things we found was that culturally, not all families believe that they are equal partners in the child's education. Some cultures believe that the school is the higher up, and we, you know, we as parents just come in and whatever you say, you know, kind of goes. And so I think that's one of the areas in terms of just different cultures. That's what we can, that's one way we can attack that problem. But I also wanted to acknowledge great teachers, again, like you. My son's teacher, I'm simultaneously, you know, texting her, and she was telling me that he was a kisser in class this week. And I sent her a text, and I said, well, he wasn't always a kisser, and I had a picture from 5 years ago where he was a biter. and it just said, you know, just wanted to let you know, this is a picture from 5 years ago, Asa, the toddler room vampire, and he looked so cute. But she was also telling me that he was sword fighting in class. So my point is that it's wonderful to receive contact from my child's teacher because it engages me in his development. So thank you so much for what both of you do in terms of educating, especially our kindergartners. So thank you.
Thank you. Okay. Kelly.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Hack, and Vice Chair Peluso, and members of the committee. I'm Kelly Poe.
Thank you.
I'm Kelly Poe, the Director of Community-Based Services at Malheur Education Service District. Thank you for the opportunity to be here today. I'm honored to highlight the work from Baker, Malheur, and Wallowa counties in the Eastern Oregon Early Learning Hub. Our hub took the requirement to use the Oregon equity lens to the community in a meaningful way. We wanted to take an opportunity to leverage the intent to genuinely and positively impact communities that support our children. We began by listening in gracious space. We held focus groups in each county in January of last year. We listened to each community's own sense of their awareness and readiness to do the work of equity. We identified our own core values, and then we realized that we have a few core values that united us as a group. Some of those values included family, love, justice, and community. In addition to required organizational self-assessments for racial equity, we asked each county to take a self-assessment of their community's awareness and readiness for action. One community is ready to do something and to take action, and the other two communities discovered that they're not ready and they need to do some homework. They're focused on raising awareness of local inequities, and then they're going to raise the level of dissatisfaction. They'll be chomping at the bit to do action soon. We're building local ownership of equity work. We're raising local leadership and passing the baton so the community is driving the bus.
So Malheur was aware and dissatisfied, and now ready to take action. An equity committee of 8 team was formed with a diverse representation of the county, including existing and emerging leaders, ethnic diversity, young and old, faith and service organizations, agency and community members. It became clear that this group wasn't interested in one issue, but in a grouping of issues with a common theme around children, families, and community. The theme was hope. It became clear to us that we're not talking about a focused action. We're interested in a more complex agenda, which is equal access to hope. It has multi-epicenters. It has multiple action sites. We're creating a movement for hope that will impact children and families, neighborhoods and communities. So once we decided that this was a movement, not just a project, we had to discover what movement leadership looks like. This has a potential to have our community change itself. The group is choosing a more complex path, a deeper path. It's a more challenging path. And the result is a long-term lasting change that will positively impact children from generations from now. This is really deep, meaningful work for us. It's not your standard response to equity, especially in Eastern Oregon. So lastly, I want to explain this slide. The Eastern Oregon Equity for Common Good is striving to live in the third circle. So there might be times that it's good to make choices that benefit yourself. That would be in the first circle. And there's times that you make choices that please others, like your family or your employer, maybe your friends, and that would be in the second circle. But when we move into the third circle, we can change the world. It's here that we can address issues of structural racism, marginalized families, disparities, and the challenging work of equity. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Kelly, just saying, I grew up in Wallawa, and I go back up there, and I appreciate enormously the work that you're doing and the changes that is creating the opportunity, because rural Oregon, in many cases, has all kinds of other challenges besides, but so
yeah.
I commend you for the work that you're doing, and this is pretty impressive, the steps, because it's not easy.
It's a challenging conversation to be had, and I get the privilege to drive to Enterprise and Joseph at least once a month.
There we go. So, thank you.
Except for this month.
Except for this one.
So, thank you, Mr. Chair. I grew up in Pendleton.
Ah,
so
good.
I can also relate, and you have distances to travel, and that is a challenge, and it's also a challenge to kind of change some ways of thinking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I appreciate your work that you're doing, and stay with it.
Thank you.
So I need a little history lesson, and maybe Dorothy, you might be able to help more, any of you. So, and Rep. Kenny Geyer and I sat on the Commission for Children's Families and Communities, and so can you walk me through
last
kind
millennium.
Of, yeah, right, kind of how that all that transition took place.
I was a commission director for Malheur County. So I only have my own story.
I've okay. told her she doesn't have to bother.
Well,
you got the expertise.
I started back in the days of Mickey Lansing.
Oh, yes, yep.
Progressed through the time. I think the story's a little different depending on where you are in the state. In my 3 counties, it was a big loss to us. And we've lost a lot of resources when we lost the Commission on Children and Families. On the other hand, we're learning to work together. We've never put Wallawa and Baker and Malheur County together for anything. That's These right, three so. Counties just, we're the East Coast from top to bottom.
Yeah.
And we've never worked together on anything. And we are learning strategies across lines that have not happened before in conversations. We're still 3 counties. So in some parts of the state, you create these hubs and you have a unit. We still are 3 counties, and we think very differently, and especially around things like equity and what the disparity is. And Wallawa County is very different than Baker, very different than Malheur or Grant or Harney or Umatilla. It's different. And so we allow those conversations to be different, and we allow them to set the pace for the change, because the change from the Commission on Children and Families to this new system has been painful for a lot of folks.
I'm in Multnomah County, and there has been tons of resistance and trying to to get the system working as we all would like it to have. So I think the challenges are probably statewide.
They are.
And I think, though, it also, though, allows this opportunity that each county or group of counties, however the it's packaged, have some great opportunities for things.
I think
it's
so.
It's been a little slower process than I anticipated.
And the way it's, well, I think the way it's designed allows for us to design what works best for our local families. Right. So it's going to have to be slow. If we do it fast, then we're all going to look alike and it's not going to work.
Yeah,
and
well,
it's not
well
going to last.
Well said. Thank you.
Christina Kindergar, did you have a...
Oh, yeah. Thank you. So I'm curious about what are clearly the loss of some resources, and certainly for the children who are 6 to 18, there's a big question about youth development and what's happened when the commission went away and was replaced by the Early Learning Hub. So I'm imagining that's part of what you might be saying. But I'm curious about the three counties coming together, because as I recall, the Early Learning Hubs were allowed, the local areas were allowed to bubble up and decide how they wanted to configure themselves, what kind of geographic, whether it was around county lines or other, or CCO boundaries. And so you used to have three different county commissions on children, families, and community, and now you decided to all go together. So I'm curious about the thinking behind that, why you did that. You've alluded to some of the benefits of learning from each other and some of the drawbacks in terms of distance. Presumably you all came up. That wasn't the state telling you. You all decided to do that. So I'm just a little curious about why you decided that, and are the pros and cons like you thought, and do the pros outweigh the cons? And do you see potential in the future, or do you think you're going to disaggregate again?
So first I'll talk about the youth in our communities. That was a very big concern of ours when the Commission on Children and Families went away. Even though the commission really focused a lot on 0 to 8, they really did do 0 to 18. So we created cradle-to-career partnerships in each one of the counties, and our early learning hub advisory is inside of that cradle-to-career partnership. Because it's in our small counties, it's the same people.
Yeah.
The same people are gathering together to talk about everything. They just switch their hats, and we continue the conversation. So that's been a really positive thing and a good place to unite us. I think in the long run, We're in a better place. Mm-hmm. We're in a lot better place. And I remember in Eastern Oregon, Peg Van Der Zanden did a lot of coordination with us. And we just said over and over, it's not about the money. Mm-hmm. It's about the partnerships. Mm-hmm. And so this new hub system is, through some required steps, is giving us the backbone or the strength or the what it needs to make those partnerships happen. It used to be difficult for in different parts of the state to get schools to the table or to get health care to the table or to get DHS. You know, everybody had a different bit of a story, but this new hub system says, no, you'll have them all at the table.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's given us that ability to leverage and to align things so it does line up for our kids and families to succeed. So it is better. Mm-hmm. And things like our organizational assessments for structural racism, that was a big thing for our Eastern Oregon communities to swallow. It's like, but it opened a conversation because we had to do it. It opened a conversation, and I knew how it was going to land. So we started talking about a year before the requirement came out and started the conversations talking about this equity, Eastern Oregon equity for common good, and talking about moving to that third circle. What's best for everyone? Because if we really look at what's going on with our marginalized families, then it's good for everyone. So I think that the hub system has given us some requirements. It gives us some backbone and some tools that we didn't have before. So I think we're in a better place. What do I think the future is? I don't know.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you for coming this far, too.
Yeah. Representative, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I appreciate your knowledge base, and I was very much a proponent of the Children and Families Commission. I was very sad to see that go, but then also saw the work of the hubs and was extremely excited about that. So I'm happy to hear that it's working on all sides of our state. Since you have such a unique background and have been on both sides, not everybody has had the opportunity to have that lens,
if you could tell us if there was something that you could change, add, do different, having that lens, what would it be?
I think our geographic regions are too big. So often in a lot of our groupings, because it seems like we're regionalizing a lot of things, a lot of different things that require services, and often you say anything from Bend Over is one group, and it's just too spread out and too diverse. And so I think it's too big. I think we have too many miles to cover. And my relationship with people in Enterprise and Joseph, it's not a day-to-day. I'm a guest. I'm very much a guest in Wallowa County. And they've been very kind and gracious, and we've done some very good work together. But I'm still a guest.
Good.
Chair Lively, thank you. I was on the Washington County Commission for Children and Families, and if it makes you feel any better, when things changed, we described as our biggest challenge in Washington County that it was too far to go from, like, Forest Grove to Beaverton. And that was the big challenge that I'm missing. I'm thinking, man, you know. So I feel for you, and I can't imagine how difficult that would be, you know. So
there's a lot of power in neighborhoods, and that's what I love about the stories that we had here today. We're really talking about really small units. We're talking about a kindergarten class inside of an elementary school, and we're talking about all the stories today were about a smaller unit. And that's, as human beings, we really want to connect like that. The reality is resources just aren't going to service that way. So how can we best use our resources to meet the most and have the greatest impact? Mm-hmm. And this is probably the best we have right now. And so we're going to make the best of it. And so our next iteration, whatever it is going to be better because of what we did today.
So. Great. Thank you so much. I think it just reinforced for all of us the diversity, the rural versus urban, all those and the challenges, but the good work that's being done. But part of it goes back to resources, unfortunately, and making sure we have enough resources. But again, thank you, all of you, for being here.
Yes, very much.
Thank you, Kelly, for traveling so far.
My pleasure.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're going to move on to... Oh, sorry. I need to follow the agenda.
Yeah.
So we'll close the informational hearing on early learning hubs and open the hearing on preschool promise. And David and Gwen are up first. Welcome once again.
Chair Lively, committee members, for the record, my name is David Mandel, Acting Early Learning System Director.
And good afternoon, Chair Lively and vice chairs, I should say. Now I'm going to Pelosi and also Hack. For the record, my name is Gwen Bachtel, and I am the Preschool Promise Program Coordinator within the Early Learning Division.
Okay, thank you. Yeah.
And my role, basically, I'm going to provide just a quick overview and then hand it over to Gwen. And it's just, I have to say, I'll use this opportunity to really embarrass her a little bit. And just to say,
I'll embarrass myself.
It's just an honor to be up here with my colleague Gwen, because she's just done an incredible job in way too short a time of taking something that was a concept on paper and making it a reality. So I just wanted to start by thanking her for that. We did have a chance last week to give you a little bit of an overview of Preschool Promise, and not to rehash too much of that, but just to go back, that Preschool Promise emerged in recognition of that far too few children have access to preschool, particularly children in that 100% to 200% poverty range, that there's a great opportunity to also to expand the kinds of opportunities and settings to meet community needs and parent choices. and also to do so in a way that allows us to also support existing programs and communities and link them to new resources in a way that I think actually leverages this investment. I also do want to just say this was, in some sense, the first year of something pretty new and pretty complicated. There's been some bumps on the road and things that we've learned, and we also want to, at the end, to talk a little bit about some of that, both the growing pains and the learning that we've been doing as part of that process. Just to remind you, this is, in some sense, what I describe as the directive that you as the legislature gave to us in implementing this program. So House Bill 3380 from 2015 made the eligibility of children up to 200% of poverty, made the hubs the applicants, and I'm really glad that we had the chance to hear from the hubs before we got into preschool problems, because I think that helps you understand the vital role that they play to this. Eligible to providers who are on our SPARC, our quality rating improvement system, and also had the requirements in the bill of instructional hours equivalent to full-day kindergarten, lead teachers with a bachelor's degree, and lead teachers' minimum salary, target salaries and minimum salaries commensurate with kindergarten teachers. And we'll talk a little bit more in detail what that's actually meant in practice. You know, I think one of the things that we talked about last time that's really most exciting about this model is the opportunity to really engage a pretty amazing variety of kinds of early learning settings into this program. I think it's supposed to be one of the most exciting potentials, and also doesn't make it the easiest model in terms of implementation. But I think, you know, that mixed delivery model has really been really essential to, I think, some of the great promise of Preschool Promise, not just the ability to expand access, which we know is really important, but to provide more variety of choices for families, to create more culturally specific opportunities. And I think one of the things that's just really exciting about the mixed delivery model is it creates opportunities for new kinds of conversation between K through 12, between Head Start, between child care programs. A lot to be learned from that, so I think we're at the start of that conversation, not the end of that conversation. But I do think that's one of the things that's made this really exciting. And with that, I'm going to hand it over to Gren.
Thank you. Thanks, David. So as David mentioned earlier, all early learning hubs were eligible to apply and respond to the Early Learning Division's request for applications. Six applications were selected for award, and as you can see in green on this map, the regions of the state covered by the program. And doing a little bit of research before I came, I think 7 of the 9 of you have Preschool Promise within your district, so pretty spread out, kind of touching all corners of the state, but, you know, a lot of it along the I-5 corridor. Looking more closely at the service plan on the right, you can see how slots were allocated by region. Slots were allocated to each applicant based on the strength of their application, the readiness of the providers in their community, and the attention paid in the to the Early Learning Council's priority populations, children of color, children experiencing poverty, and children experiencing a developmental disability or a delay or needing special education services. And now I want to move on to show some of the progress that we've made. So we did it. Well, actually, I should say the early learning hubs did it. We have a true mix of providers types in this first year of implementation. One of the two largest provider types are school districts and child care providers, both registered and certified family child care, followed by certified centers and also Head Start programs. I do want to mention, even though this is by site, so how many sites are serving, that's what this represents, that actually Head Start has 24% of the actual enrollment. So even though they have a smaller number of sites that are in the mix, they're actually serving almost 24% of the children in Preschool Promise. And those are mostly in like a blended or mixed classroom. And based on the student demographic data that I'll share on the next slide, it appears that the hubs did an excellent job in selecting the right providers for the job, because these providers seem to have the ability to reach the priority populations we're trying to reach. And that was what we were kind of hoping to see. Okay, we have the providers, that was the first task, but are they actually going to be reaching the populations that we're hoping to? So out of the original data that we collected with 1,259 students within that collection, oops, there's the two next, we had a a majority of the children within the children of color. Our highest percentage group was Hispanic with 46%, and then followed right behind that with children who identify as white. And then in regard to the diverse languages, we primarily English-speaking, but then that also we had 35% of the children identifying that Spanish was either a primary or home language. But I think it's sometimes hard to tell because we have so many children who have multi-languages now, where they might identify English as English proficient, but they also have another home language. And so this really doesn't get at some of those nuances, I don't think. And then looking at the income levels, a majority of the children enrolled live in families whose income is between 101 to 200% of the federal poverty levels. So this indicates progress toward the goal of expanded access of the publicly funded preschool. And then as we build capacity and refine our efforts to offer culturally and linguistically responsive services, staff demographics can provide us a snapshot of who is interacting with the children enrolled in the programs. And so currently the largest demographic group amongst our staff is white, with all the other groups representing just less than 50%. But then if we looked at language, and it's not represented here, we had over 34% of the staff that were collected in this that had language other than English. So they're able to, and most of that was 28% indicated that they are fluent in Spanish, and then we also had 3% Russian, and then another 3% that there are other Burmese, Chinese, Vietnamese, and also Portuguese. So we had a lot of variety amongst language proficiencies. And this included not just the lead teachers, but also all of the assistants and also any support staff. As mentioned earlier, one of the goals of Preschool Promise is to professionalize and increase compensation for the early childhood workforce. And this was sort of a statistic that kind of caught me a little bit. I was surprised to see that 77% of the lead teachers in Preschool Promise have a bachelor degree or higher. And professional development supports are available for staff to work towards attaining their BA if they don't have it. And also that there are professional supports to improve practice as well. So even if teachers already have a bachelor's degree, that there are funds available for them to improve their practice. The Early Learning Council established minimum and target salary requirements for Preschool Promise teachers. The methodology utilized regional school district data and tiered the salary targets by education level. So it was really important to the Early Learning Council that we took into account the different salaries of kindergarten teachers within the regions that are served by the hub, recognizing that's not quite the same maybe in Eastern Oregon, in Kelly's region, as it is maybe in Multnomah, so that we use actual kindergarten teacher data to come up with our target salaries for Preschool Promise. And then, so the statewide range for either Step 10 bachelor degree or higher ranged between 34 and 63. That was our target. And in the first year, we actually came back with out of the 87 teachers that we had data on, that the average was 46,500. So that is a significant increase to reaching that pay parity for our early learning workforce. This next slide indicates the average cost per enrollment opportunity by provider type for the same level of quality programming. These quality indicators include a 1 to 10 adult child ratio, class sizing of 20 or less, a minimum of 900 hours of service, comprehensive services and staff salary requirements. The variations by provider type reflect the differences in potentially transportation services that are being offered, benefits or full compensation packages, and administrative and facility costs. You can see that for a registered family or certified family, they might not have the same type of compensation package that a K-12 provider might be offering. And so that would be, you know, in the cost of the cost per child. And I also like to add just a comment I made earlier about Preschool Promise. I think it was a question around the housing, and that Preschool Promise was kind of fulfilling that child care need for the family that had sought housing. And even though Preschool Promise offers 900 hours of direct service annually, that doesn't necessarily mean that it fulfills all families' need for child care. And so I just wanted to, it works for some families, but there are a lot of families who need additional services or wraparound care to meet their families' needs for child care. So, And that overall, the average cost, if we were to average all these out, per child, it's $10,758 for Preschool Promise. And during this first year, as I tend to refer to it, our learning year, we learned a lot and acknowledged that we encountered some challenges. Our first challenge was working through the DAS procurement process and having all providers meet the insurance levels that were required, and this delayed getting funding out into the communities. And due to this delay, the hubs and providers experienced a time crunch to begin services. And we missed an opportunity during that time crunch to engage in necessary collaboration work with other providers, specifically Head Start for coordinated service distribution and enrollment and recruitment. We were just really tight. So we have begun statewide work to support hubs and Head Starts on the development of MOUs that will ensure collaboration and mutual success. And we also learned that income eligibility or only income eligibility requirements can sometimes limit our ability to reach children furthest from opportunity, that stringent staff qualifications might unintentionally screen out highly skilled early educators, and that alternate QRS pathways might better support the mix of providers that we are bringing into Preschool Promise. So thank you for your time today. And as we move into this next biennium, we are committed to strengthening systems that support continuous quality improvements for all pre-kindergarten programs and to build capacity within the hub regions.
Thank you very much. Yeah. Any questions? Representative, can you go ahead?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, I'm asking so many questions.
No, it's not a problem.
Thank you, Gwen. I just heard something about a ratio of 1 to 20 on a previous slide. What was that referring to?
We have the requirements within the state of Oregon are 1 to 10, one adult for every 10 children in preschool, and then the maximum class size is 20.
Oh, class size.
Yes.
You could have a second assistant.
Yes. Right.
Isn't there a 1 to 15 for kids that are 5, for 4 and 5-year-olds? Or is it what?
Within the state licensing, once they get into that older range, right before kindergarten, because they have a mixed age group, there are some providers that have the ability to go to 1 to 15. But because Preschool Promise required all providers to be a 4 or 5 star rating on QRIS, QRIS has qualifications or quality indicators around staff to child ratios.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you very much. So three more that are going to provide us information, Lisa, Josie, and Chantel. Marion Polk Early Learning Hub.
Yes.
Loving Beginnings and Faces.
Absolutely.
Okay, very good. Welcome.
All right. So good afternoon, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Representative Peluso. It's so great and very exciting to be with you here today to talk about one of my most favorite things about being the executive director of an early learning hub. I am the director for the Marion and Polk Early Learning Hub. We have
and
been.
You introduce your name, please, for the record.
Lisa Harnish.
Thank you.
My apologies for not saying that.
That's all right.
Goodness. My apologies. We have been so fortunate to have been able to bring Preschool Promise into our community. So I just want to thank the legislature for your investment in that, and this has truly made an impact in our community. Preschool Promise has really allowed us the ability to provide more access and capacity to preschool environments that is working to help shape and ensure that our children are more ready for kindergarten. It's also helping us to focus on increasing the level of quality of those environments for our preschool children. And this is also allowing us to focus on the workforce development of those individuals providing care for our children. So this Preschool Promise really is that multifaceted approach and is helping us make that change in the overall system. We have done some foundational work, I believe, in our community to help us in being ready for Preschool Promise. You heard a little bit about it earlier from our colleagues from Woodburn School District with the Kindergarten Partnership and Innovation. That has been instrumental in helping us to begin building that bridge between early learning providers and into our K-12 world. So that there's an understanding of what happens before and after, so to speak.
We've also done some significant work in partnership with our child care resource and referral to help ensure that our child care providers are able to get into and be successful in their journey on the Quality Rating Improvement System, or SPARC, therefore increasing the quality standards that we have for our child care environments. Through this work, we've been able to really come together as a community to help plan and be ready for Preschool Promise. And that's where that collaboration, and I think what really the desire and the intention of us at HUB is to be that convener and collaborator and really that catalyst for action. So we brought together our community to help identify how and where and our approaches to Preschool Promise. And it's there that we were really working with all of our providers across the board. But now it's really about sort of the numbers and how are we doing now that we've implemented. As a colleague said before, this has been a very rapid fire year. When I think about it, even a year ago at this time, we didn't know if we were going to be a Preschool Promise site. And since then, we have been hitting the ground running ever since. So Marion and Polk County was very fortunate to have available to us 330 enrollment opportunities across the community. We have, and this is data, this is actually current data, we have every one of those spaces filled. And I think what's really important is to note that we have right now 94 who are on waiting lists if the provider chooses to keep a waiting list. Some of them may not. And what we do know about that 94, that number of 94, is about 95% of them are within the poverty range of 101 to 200%, right? And we all know that that's really the gap that we're really striving for. Of our 330 children who are participating in Preschool Promise, approximately 70% are in that 101 to 200%. And below 100% is about 30 or 31%. So right there, we've got, I think, a really good blend. And what that says to me is that we have a lot of opportunities for families in Head Start to participate, or Oregon Pre-Kindergarten. And most of those are half-day programs. Preschool Promise is a full-day program. And one thing that we have worked together with our Head Start partners is to make sure that we're providing that access and honoring parent choice, because that's really been a value set of our community in doing that. We have... And you can see here we've got more four-year-olds in the program than we do three-year-olds, not by a whole lot, but and what we know is those individuals will then be transitioning into kindergarten this next year. And then three-year-olds have the opportunity to stay as a part of Preschool Promise. So again, knowing that that dosage matters and really wanting to invest in those children all the way through. We've worked really hard to find providers across our community that would represent. We actually took mixed delivery very seriously. Of all the various buckets, so to speak, we've got representation from almost every one of those, the service provider types. In addition, many of our providers have mixed classrooms where they have Preschool Promise kids along with, you know, other children. So we were not having those segregated classrooms in many, many instances, which I think is really important for us as a community. And we have nine family child care providers who are doing this in their home, which is a really big undertaking for many of our family child care providers to be able to deliver a program and work with this type of structure that we have. So we've been doing a lot of technical assistance with those providers. We have
have one faith-based group that also is our Russian-speaking provider. And so they deliver a lot of instruction in Russian as well. We have two school districts. We have two programs, one at Western and also one at Shemeketa Community College. So we're serving also parents who are going to school as well. We also have a classroom at the Confederated Tribe of Grand Ronde. And then we also have community-based organizations such as Faces of America, OCDC, or Oregon Child Development Coalition, who are also providing preschool promise. So we really run the gamut. Our providers have anywhere from 5 to what, OCDC actually has 100 slots or enrollment opportunities across 3 different programs. So really, again, runs that gamut, which is very exciting. We've been working with our providers on any technical assistance that they may need, including some of the business requirements and some of the contracting requirements as defined by the Early Learning Division. Also have been working very intently with them as they are on their journey for the Quality Rating Improvement System, or SPARC, to make sure that they could be at that star 4 or 5 level, and really helping to ensure that the environment is where we want to invest. We have literacy supports for our providers. We partner with SMART, Start Making a Reader Today. We also have literacy backpacks that go home with children. We are working on being able to deliver a dental and oral health education, as well as some of the fluoride varnishes. So we're planning for that this spring. Developmental screens, of course, are part, and also providing some information and guidance for providers to offer to their families around well child checks. The last piece that I think is so exciting about the work that we are doing is around parent engagement and parent education. Each of our providers are working with their families to connect them in with resources or parent education, and really helping them as they're in their parenting skills, as well as helping them in that transition between the preschool years and into kindergarten. So it's been very exciting to see, and we're just delighted to be a part of Preschool Promise, and we are looking forward to it continuing on for many years to come. But I brought actually with me two individuals who can tell you even more about Preschool Promise and specifically about the impact of the program. We have Josie Emmerich with Loving Beginnings. She is the owner and director there, and she has an in-home facility. And then also Chantel Belloc, a parent of a child at Faces of America. So I'm going to turn it over to them.
Thank you. I'm Josie Emmerich. Good afternoon, Chair Lively, Vice Chair Peluso, and Vice Chair Hack, and members of the committee. I'm really happy to be here and to be able to talk to you guys about my program. I am the teacher and the owner of a certified in-home child care and preschool. My program partners with both the Early Head Start program and Preschool Promise. I actually got into my partnership with Preschool Promise because I was working with Early Head Start, and I really didn't want to see a lot of my kids go to the different classroom. Mm-hmm. I really believe in that continuity of care, and being able to work with families for that first 5 years is really important. So I serve 5 Preschool Promise children, 4 Early Head Start children, and 3 private families, which a lot of those 3 are siblings of children that are also in the program. They're on waiting lists. It's really nice to be able to offer that continuity of care to families and build those relationships to support them when they move on to kindergarten. I really feel strongly about the first 5 years of life being critical to the child's brain development. I've done a lot of work on learning about this and how important it is, and making sure that those first experiences really count. And I know from my work with children that it's really important that I start with them early, And so that's one of the reasons why I really enjoy working with both programs and being able to really get to know the child and offer that unique care that they need. They need special care. They need relationships to learn. And so I also am able to do things like we do daily toothbrushing, and you know, I offer parent support on parenting. And
you said the magic words. With you.
Well, I heard that. I was like, "Hey, we do
you
that."
Say, okay, we do that.
So, I mean, just things like that. I have 12 children, and we have a low ratio, and that's able. I'm able to do that because of my partnership with Preschool Promise. So between the partnerships, they've helped me to improve the quality of my program. I'm able to pay support staff so that way we can improve the adult-child relationships. They give me resources so that way I can get, you know, sick time and vacation time and be able to purchase health insurance and invest in retirement. I've had opportunities to purchase really high quality learning materials, which are really just not things that you get as in-home child care providers. So those things really help, and to be able to access people that can help if there's something that I need help with. I think as in-home providers, a lot of times we work a lot of extra hours, and we have a lot of times children that have high needs, and there's not resources for us to tap into. And I see over and over again a lot of provider burnout and a lot of people that are really frustrated, and it leads to children being let go from programs, and that really starts a cycle that we just don't want to see. So by putting money into our programs, we're able to really to offer that small group environment and to work with these kids that might have to leave other programs. And so, you know, I've got kids that have been with me from newborn all the way to kindergarten, and because of the relationships I've built with them and their families, I wouldn't think of letting them go. We kind of stick together with anything that comes up. And so I think that the home-based childcare relationships are really important to this program, and I was kind of looking at the slides, and it doesn't cost as much to support us. So you know, right, I think we're ideal candidates for this kind of a program.
Thank you very much. So. Very observant on your part. Yes.
I just really believe in this program, and I think I've enjoyed working with the families that they don't normally qualify for services, and they get free preschool, and they're pretty appreciative of that. They're more likely to volunteer. They're more likely to help out, and I see them more often, and they're just really happy that their child is getting preschool and it's in a quality environment. And so they it's been a really, really good opportunity for me.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello. Good afternoon, Chair Lively. Vice Chair Peluso and Vice Chair Hack and everybody else in the committee. Nice to meet you. My name is Chantel Belloc, and I have two children. My youngest is Matthew. He's 4 years old, and he was fortunate enough to be able to use the Preschool Promise resources. He is going to Faces of America. Really cool program. I wanted to volunteer today to speak with you guys and share my thanks and gratitude and give you guys some insight into what's actually happening. I think the Preschool Promise is a really neat program. I've been so impressed just listening to everybody talk and give the facts and the data. I knew there was a lot that went into it, but that's really great. It has the ability to make such a huge impact. It's just really neat. I wish we had more resources to help more children. I think it's a very well-known fact that children learn the most between ages of 1 through 5. And this is such an important time to help expose children to everything. The beautiful thing that I appreciate the most about the Preschool Promise Program was that they gave the opportunity to children and families that wouldn't normally have the opportunity to apply. My son Matthew, he has shown such amazing leaps and bounds since he was able to go to preschool. He has some sensory and attachment issues, and the Preschool Promise Program has just really helped open him up so much. And it wouldn't be possible without Preschool Promise. I definitely appreciate it. And I would have appreciated this so much more a few years ago when our oldest son was going through preschool. At the time, my husband was recently disabled and lost use of his hands. And previous to that, we made really decent money between the two of us. And we didn't qualify for any type of assistance so that our then 4-year-old could go to preschool. And we've definitely seen such a huge impact. As it stands, I don't know if you had a chance to read my letter, but my 4-year-old has better handwriting than my 8-year-old does right now. No joke. My 8-year-old is trying, but he's, I think, just lazy. But my 4-year-old is doing amazing. And he's so loving, and he's done so well. Like I mentioned, he had sensory issues and attachment issues. And he never would have had the opportunity to experience being around all these different people, children, and really learn to become confident within himself. The program, it's not in-home care, it's an organization, FACES, but it really is kind of like a family. They take the time to almost do individualized care. We believe very strong in education. We taught our children very young their ABCs, shapes, all of that. So when he got there, they were really surprised that he already knew all of that because we had worked with him for so long. But there were other issues that the other kids were way above for him. And they've really done such a great job making sure that they're all on the same page and working on it. So I just wanted to say thank you for giving them the opportunity. And I hope that you keep continuing to support this mission for the Preschool Promise for families that wouldn't otherwise qualify. Because when we were trying for our oldest, it was so hard because even though we had good money and we had a decent savings, when he couldn't use his hands anymore, we couldn't afford it. And we didn't qualify for anything. We just weren't there anymore. And it was really hard to find where we were going to come up with that money. So thank you.
Thank you for coming and visiting. Thank you all.
Just comment.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have to say great job because, you know, this hub's in my district. And I just have to give you a lot of props, because I'm pretty proud. So thanks, Lisa, for all your hard work. And couldn't be prouder. And thanks for the work you're doing. And I actually got to visit FACES, so I may have got to see your little guy. I'm guessing I probably did. Probably. They were stellar. And I'm going to go back and read a book because I walked in the door and they go, are you here to read to us? yes, and I didn't get to that day, but I'll be back. So, you know, thanks for all you do. It's the boots on the ground people that make a difference in these little guys' lives. So thank you and just thanks for everything that you've done and just proud to say you're my hub, man.
Very good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I also want to thank you. It's clear, both from the perspective of the child care provider, what this can do to stabilize, to have ongoing revenue that you can count on to stabilize that population, your business model, and the child-adult relationships that are so important. Because we know when there's not stable funding for child care and people might lose a job, that kind of disruption is horrendous. So I appreciate that aspect of it from somebody who runs a business but also really cares about the development of the child. And then also to see the potential of this program and the impact that it has on the children and their families. It's really two wonderful perspectives, and I know that there have been some bumps getting it off the ground, but clearly we can see the potential here. I had the opportunity to visit one in my own neighborhood about a week before the session started. It was very impressive. We don't have time really for questions, but I hope that we get an opportunity to hear in this field. I know one of the big challenges is substitute pools, because K-12 system has a substitute pool, and had we had more time, I would ask you, what do you do when one of your providers is sick and you've got a ratio that you need to meet? So just please put that on the list of how do we support. It's really important for the providers and for the children to be able to count on having people there who are not coming in sick because they know they have to be there. That's not a good solution. So thank you so much.
Thank you all. I'm going to close the informational hearing. Zena and all of those involved with today's presentations, great job and an overview of all that's going on and the values from those things. I think it's working. So thank you all for that. Anything for the good of the order?
That's great.
Good of the order?
That's great.